Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, and discuss the real cause of the high costs of gas and food in America, and that is the speculation on Wall Street that has distorted the commodities market while unnecessarily impoverishing most Americans in order to enrich a few. Then we will discuss the reassignment of the head of the ATF over a sting operation that lost track of 2,500 high-powered firearms. Dennis Hennigan, the author of Lethal Logic, Exploding the Myths That Paralyze America's Gun Policy, joins us to examine the truth behind the posturing of lawmakers who have systematically weakened gun control laws and the ATF's ability to enforce what laws still exist while proclaiming outrage over the botched Fast and Furious operation. Then finally, we'll talk with Raed Jarrah, an Iraqi-American political analyst and blogger who was recently in Iraq. We will look into the continuing political paralysis and instability of the government in the Green Zone as the U.S. pulls out of a country it devastated, and also examine the likely spillover of the revolution going on next door in Syria. Joining us now is Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. Currently, he is the director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, where he also teaches constitutional law and a seminar on futures, options, and derivatives at the University of Maryland School of Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Greenberger.
Very nice to be here.
And Michael, you're the lead story here today. And I just only wish that this was the lead story in our press, because it seems to me there is nothing more important than the public understanding why the cost of the very basic things that we have, food and gasoline, have gone up so high, so often, and so recently, and what is behind it. You would think that that would be a compelling subject.
Well, it is a compelling subject, and if properly understood by the American public, I think the government would act in a way to stifle really big Wall Street firms, big hedge funds, wealthy investors from essentially playing casino with the futures markets, which are designed for commercial users of these products to hedge their products. Instead, what we have is a casino operation that is driving the price of major food staples, major energy products up, really at the behest of speculators, and unmooring these prices from supply-demand fundamentals.
So in other words, if the public really knew what was going on and how much that directly affects their pocketbook, they'd be outraged and want something to be done about it and force the government to act on their behalf.
I think that's absolutely true. And on September 22nd, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which has the principal mission under the Dodd-Frank statute that was passed in July of 2010 to pass regulations that were intended by Congress to stifle excessive speculation and the driving up of prices with no rationale to production or development or real economic concerns, they are going to hold a meeting in which they will adopt final regulations which were intended to implement this congressional concern over this issue. In January of 2011, they proposed the rules to be put in effect, and most progressive observers of the proposed rules and their impact have essentially told the Commodity Futures Trading Commission that this is regulation in name only. It doesn't discipline wealthy speculators and wealthy speculative institutions. It doesn't fulfill the intention of Congress. Rather, it only keeps the status quo ante, which is massive infusion in these markets of speculative money, which have driven the price of food and energy products, especially crude oil, through the roof.
Now, isn't there a problem, Michael Greenberger, again, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, isn't there a problem with the commission itself? There, I think it's, what, five commissioners? And my understanding is that the most recent commissioner, who's a Democrat appointed by the Bush administration, is voting with the Republicans?
Well, here's the problem right now. As is true of all independent federal agencies, the statutory template going back decades is that the president's party gets three of the five seats, and the party that is not of the president's gets two of the seats. So we have three Democrats and two Republicans. The two Republicans, to varying degrees, have been very hostile to the adoption of the financial regulations that have been imposed by Dodd-Frank that are intended to prevent the kind of reckless gambling, the reckless speculation, the undercapitalized speculation, the non-transparent speculation that led us into the meltdown of 2008. So two of the Republicans come with great deal of skepticism. The chairman, who is appointed by President Obama, Gary Gensler, who is a former partner at Goldman Sachs, and people were skeptical about his performance. He has come in as a true progressive, one of the leading regulators in the Obama administration, and he is, I would say, very much wants to limit this wild speculative activity. There's another commissioner who was in place, a Democratic commissioner, Commissioner Chilton, who supports him. And what you were getting at is there is a Democrat who was appointed by President Bush, Commissioner Dunn, who has veered back and forth, sometimes joining the two Democrats to form a majority, sometimes joining with the Republicans to defeat the Obama administration appointees. The fear is certainly the commentary that was made when the proposed rule came out, the very weak proposed rule, was that there would not be three votes in favor even for a rule that allows the status quo to take place. In other words, they want to open the floodgates to speculation. What we are hoping for is there was so much commentary on the proposed rule, 12,000 comments were filed, many by Wall Street interests who want to keep speculative activity alive and well. But there were an awful lot of progressive groups and businesses who've been adversely affected by this speculative fever, which has prevented them from being able to hedge their pricing exposure, opposing it. What we're hoping is on September 22nd, the swing commissioner, Commissioner Dunn, will side with the two Obama administration appointees, and we will get a rule that really limit speculation. If we can get that rule, economists at Princeton, Stanford, Rice, Noriel Rubini, the famous economist from the New York Stern Business School, and many, many others have said that eliminating speculation and allowing these markets to be used for its intent, which is to hedge price exposure by producers and consumers of staples, will have an immediate and drastic impact on the price of food and energy, and for the most part, those prices will go down. And what is our principal inflationary problem in the United States, and what is a matter of whether food is put on the table or not in third world countries, whether there's widespread starving or starvation going on, we can defeat all that by implementing the intent of the many members of Congress that put Dodd-Frank into place and wanted this speculation stopped.
Well, given the price that that most Americans pay and that the rest of the world in terms of the less developed countries are paying for this, as I say, it's an unnecessary impoverishment that only enriches a very few because they managed to write these rules that allow them to do things that benefit them, but they don't but they actually hurt the end users. Is it possible that you could create a regime in the commodities market where the end users are the only ones that are allowed to speculate or to hedge?
Well, not only is it possible, but one of the first bills Franklin Delano Roosevelt sent to the New Deal Congress was an answer to the plea of farmers who were upset about speculators disrupting what are hedging markets. They're not capital assessing markets, but merely designed not to bring profit, but to hedge against price increase. They saw in unregulated markets that speculators played games with these markets and drove the price in any direction they so chose. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the New Deal Congress said, look, we're just not going to allow excessive speculation in these markets. We're going to place limits on the amount of people who have no interest in the underlying product, wouldn't be able to differentiate among the various kinds of wheat that are sold in these futures markets or the various kinds of crude oil. They can only participate up to a limited extent so they don't interfere with these markets. What happened in the early 90s is Wall Street got exceptions to these limitations, and markets that were predominantly used by commercial users are today 80% used by speculators. Dodd-Frank emphatically said, this has got to stop. The American consumer is paying to put money in the pockets of Wall Street, and it has nothing to do with finding oil or producing food. And what has happened is, despite the clear mandate of the Congress and President Obama's leadership, the agency that must implement this may end up being a rogue agency that just defies what this Congress has done, defies what Franklin Delano Roosevelt saw as a wise policy and a policy that worked from 1936 to the early 90s. And they just, because the Wall Street interests are so powerful and so predominant, that they are just going to cave in, and we are going to essentially be in the kind of volatile market we're in today. For example, if you look at the price of crude, the price of crude is supposed to adhere to supply-demand fundamentals. The supply-demand fundamentals over the last 6 weeks haven't changed, but the price of crude has gone in a correlated fashion with the stock market. When speculators are buying in the stock market, they're buying these crude futures contracts. When they're dumping stocks, they're dumping crude. So that price isn't adhering to price-demand fundamentals, but it's gone from 100 down to 75. It is now approaching 90 again because the stock market is going up the last several days. And that just demonstrates this has nothing to do with supply-demand. The American consumers are essentially paying for food and oil depending on how much money rich speculators want to throw into the market. We can stop this overnight. There are a lot of strong advocates in Congress. Bernie Sanders of Vermont, one of the leading ones, Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington, Dianne Feinstein of California, who have been very strong on this issue. But everything is dependent on this commission. And if you had to bet today, we're going to be very disappointed on September 22nd, and the American consumer will be forced to put money in the pockets of Wall Streeters and to build houses in the Hamptons, build speedboats and yachts for these investors, and none of this money will go into production of, for example, crude oil.
Well, I guess that's another discussion about the nature of this, of our speculative capitalism, how it's all about extracting wealth and not creating wealth, and it's untenable and unsupportable in the long run. But just in the short term, how do you form coalitions? I mean, obviously, the first thing is, which is what we're doing now, is trying to inform the public about what really is behind the cost of gasoline and food. And it's a huge percentage. What would you say the percentage of speculation is?
Well, it's absolutely clear. The ideal market template is 70% commercial users of the underlying product, if you're talking about crude oil, people who produce and consume, businesses that produce and consume crude oil, should be 70% of those participating in these markets and 30% speculators. What these markets, and when you look across the wide array of commodities, it's 80% speculation and 20% commercial. And that's why airlines and trucking companies and farmers have joined with unions, consumers, public interest groups, environmentalists to say, you've got to stop this. You're forcing our customers to pay an unnecessary premium for this product. So there are coalitions. There's something called Americans for Financial Reform, which is a coalition of unions, consumer groups, and environmentalists, and public interest groups who have been fighting this battle. There are certain businesses like airlines, truckers, heating oil dealers, petroleum marketers who are fighting the battle. But unfortunately, we have not been able to explain to the rank and file how simple it could be to knock this point of inflation out of the economy. Sadly, and very disappointingly, while the president supported this measure as it went through Congress, he's almost said nothing, a couple of sentences, about this issue. I wish that the bully pulpit of the presidency was being used to point this thing out. But as you can well imagine, the other side are massive trading companies, massive banks, and in our unfortunate political finance environment, too many people are looking to have their campaign coffers filled by the wealthy and are not prepared to speak out on behalf of the average person. I think that's politically foolhardy. I think if the president were to come out and make a strong statement about this, he would gather in phenomenal support. His polling is sinking. He needs to rally the average American and help the average American. That's one way we could quickly fix this problem.
Well, it's worth noting, Michael Greenberger, that Eric Cantor spoke recently before the trade group that represents the speculators and promised them if the Republicans took over next year that they would have he would make sure that they made life easier for them. So
absolutely.
So there's no question about and we know from the summer of 2008 that the price went up to $147 a barrel of oil. Later, 60 Minutes did an investigation finding out that the biggest holders of oil weren't OPEC or ExxonMobil, but they were Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs. And they were driving supertankers around in circles, you know.
Yes, and there's thanks to Bloomberg and the late famous and very missed reporter Mark Pittman, who put FOIA requests in across the government. We now have figures that show even more dramatically that the biggest investors in these markets are the big banks, not ExxonMobil, not the traditional users, but banks who are using their power of trading to drive these prices up needlessly. Franklin Delano Roosevelt spotted this at the beginning of his presidency in 1933. By 1936, he got legislation in place that was designed to limit excessive speculation. It was eaten away by stealth exemptions in the 90s and in the first decade of this century. It's unfortunate that Congress identified this problem, tried to fix it, but it's now been left to the politics of agency rulemaking, and one hopes for the best, but I'm sorry, I expect the worst unless the American public wakes up to what's happening to them.
Well, the predators are out there. I just in closing, Michael Greenberger, you know, it's no small irony that the biggest salesman for gold, which is a total, it's fool's gold, you know, and people are flocking into it and driving the price up. The biggest salesmen are if you listen to watch the advertising, is on Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck's shows, and now there's a bubble that's going to burst, right? wouldn't you say?
Well, it's already started to burst. I mean, it is.
But all those people are going to be fleeced that put their money in, and they have these useless contracts that they can't get out of.
Right. And by the way, when oil was at the world record high of $147, within 6 months it went down to 33, basically because the speculators decided to go in the other direction. Yes, and the honest users of these markets, people who are trying to deal with them honestly, get fleeced, get hammered. If supply-demand is the essential factor in the cost of these products, you can't explain oil being in 68 in July of 2007, 147 in July of 2008, 33 in December of 2008, and now up near 100 again. And when the debt ceiling downgrade crisis started, the price of oil dropped as the stock market dropped. As the stock market has recovered, oil has recovered. Price-demand fundamentals have nothing to do with this. It's the amount of wealthy investor, wealthy institution money that now dictates the price we pay for gasoline and our food.
I thank you for joining us, Michael Greenberger.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. Currently is the director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, where he also teaches constitutional law and a seminar on futures options and derivatives at the University of Maryland School of Law. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the reassignment of the head of ATF.
Blankets for the winter. There's no oil in the lamp. And I'd like to write my congressman, but I can't afford the stamp. You want me to pay my taxes so you can propagate your lie? Well, those barefoot dudes down in New Orleans looking like they're gonna die.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dennis Hennigan, who is the acting president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence and founder of the Center's Legal Action Project. He is the author of Lethal Logic, Exploding the Myths That Paralyze Americans' Gun Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dennis Hennigan. Are you there, Dennis?
Yes, I am. It's nice to be with you.
It's good to be with you. And I wanted to talk to you about the reassignment of the acting head of ATF, Kenneth Melson, who has been embroiled in this botched sting operation, Operation Fast and Furious, which chair of the Republican chair of the Oversight Committee, Darrell Issa, has made a kind of an issue out of it. Just to get some background here, he's the acting head of ATF. There's no permanent head of ATF. President Obama nominated as the head of ATF Andrew Traver, but he's been held up because of strong opposition from the National Rifle Association. Melson's moved aside to a job in justice, and replacing him as ATF's acting director will be Todd Jones, the U.S. attorney for the District of Minnesota. But this shuffling about begs the question of why is this agency has for so long, for decades, been headed by an acting director? Dennis, are you there? We apparently lost the call here. Could you call back immediately and get hold of Dennis?
Yes, I
can
hear
there you are. What happened?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
But I did hear your question. And, you've pinpointed the problem. This is an agency that for many years has been without a permanent director. In fact, it's been that way since the Congress made the director of ATF subject to congressional approval. And what has happened is the gun lobby has used its influence in the Congress to block various nominees for that position, including Mr. Traver, because quite frankly, the NRA doesn't want a strong, effective director of ATF. It doesn't want a strong, effective ATF. In fact, it basically wants to destroy ATF because it really doesn't want our gun laws to be enforced. And so this fast and furious operation, which has become so controversial, basically is a result of the lack of strong leadership, and it's also the result of the absence of strong laws, which would give ATF effective tools to combat gun trafficking. ATF has tried to do the best it can with what it has, and obviously it made mistakes in this particular operation. But we need to be focusing on the real problem, which is the United States Congress refusing to give ATF the tools it needs, the permanent director it needs, because the gun lobby does not want our gun laws to be actively enforced.
And just for the benefit of the audience, the Operation Fast and Furious was a sting operation that allowed a lot of firearms, at least 2,500 firearms, into the hands of straw purchasers, mostly in the border areas, in the hopes of making a bigger case. And it does seem that nobody was in charge of this. At least nobody seems to be taking responsibility for who organized this. You know, the president says he didn't authorize it, and the attorney general didn't authorize it. It's difficult to know who actually authorized it.
Well, and again, the problem is that you have these straw buyers who go into these border state gun shops, and they will walk out with 5, 10, 15 assault rifles at a time. And these are the kinds of high-powered rifles that the cartel wants very much, because they can fire multiple rounds without the need to reload, and law enforcement feels very much outgunned by criminals bearing this kind of firepower. Our laws should be strong enough so it is not possible for a gun dealer to sell 10, 20, or 30 assault rifles at a time. In fact, our laws should be strong enough so that a gun dealer can't sell a single assault rifle. And in fact, for 10 years in this country, we had a ban on precisely these kinds of assault rifles that the cartels in Mexico favor. But again, the power of the gun lobby in Congress was such that that ban was allowed to expire, was not renewed by the United States Congress, and that leads to this situation where the best we can do is try to follow the guns after they leave the gun store and try to interdict them and try to arrest the traffickers, when we should not be permitting these guns to be sold in the first place.
Well, clearly, Dennis Hannigan, again, the acting president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence and founder of the Center's Legal Action Project, clearly there's a lot of posturing going on, particularly on the part of Darrell Issa, the chairman of the House Oversight Committee. He seems to be trying to tie this botched sting to President Obama, and he's now saying that there's a scandal here that reaches much higher into the Obama administration. And the fact that these firearms ended up in many crimes, including found at the scene of U.S. Border Patrol agents' murder last year, of course, adds fuel to that fire. But it seems to me that this is incredibly hollow posturing here, given what you've been telling us, and which I think is fairly clear, that these same lawmakers who are expressing outrage now have been systematically weakening gun control laws and the ATF's ability to enforce what laws still exist. I mean, let's just explain to the audience the importance of the Tyhard Amendment, which is the put in by a Republican congressman that effectively makes it impossible for the information that we're talking about from these straw purchases to be shared with local law enforcement.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the what has become known as the Tiahrt Amendment, after its sponsor, Todd Tiahrt, who incidentally is no longer in Congress. He was defeated last time around. But the Tiahrt Amendment blocked public and law enforcement access to vital crime gun trace data. And this was the data that, for example, was telling us that almost 60% of crime guns throughout our country, not just the ones going to Mexico, but throughout our country, originated with about 1% of the nation's gun dealers, which suggests that the problem of the criminal market in guns is largely a problem of corrupt gun dealers who aid and abet precisely the kind of trafficking we're talking about. But this kind of information is very threatening to gun dealers. It was very threatening to the gun lobby, which would like people to believe that all these gun dealers are law-abiding and they have nothing to do with creating the illegal market, and that the illegal market is formed entirely by criminals stealing guns from law-abiding citizens. And so what does the gun lobby do? Because the information is so threatening, it shuts down public access to the information. It wants the public to be ignorant of exactly what is going on when this kind of trafficking occurs. And there's simply no question that the gun lobby has devoted itself to making sure that federal law enforcement does not have the tools to control this kind of trafficking. It is very difficult, for example, for ATF to put out of business, to lift the licenses of those corrupt gun dealers, precisely because years ago the gun lobby put restrictions on ATF and erected such a high standard of proof that it's very, very difficult for ATF to attack these corrupt gun dealers. So time and time again, the ATF has weakened ATF, or the gun lobby has weakened ATF. And we have another more recent example where the Obama administration is trying to impose a rule that simply requires border state gun dealers to report multiple sales of these semi-automatic rifles that take these high-capacity ammunition magazines, again, the kind of guns that the cartel wants. All the Obama administration wants to do is require dealers to report when large volume sales of these guns occur so that they get real-time notice of these highly suspicious transactions so that they can figure out who the traffickers are and they can go after them and they can interdict the guns before they get to the border. And yet, the gun lobby is opposing that. They are suing the Obama administration to stop it. I dare say Daryl Issa strongly opposes it as well. So every time there is a move to give ATF the tools it needs to be a strong and effective agency, the gun lobby and its friends in Congress try to prevent that from happening.
And now Daryl Issa is trying to grab headlines, posturing outrage at this botched operation, which you've pointed out, Dennis Hennigan, is actually a result of the fact that the Congress has weakened the ATF to the point where it has had no leadership, and thus these kinds of sting operations end up getting out of control. I mean, that seems to be the story here.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. As a matter of fact, in a hearing that Daryl Issa convened on this Fast and Furious operation, you know, he called as witnesses ATF agents who had actually questioned the operation, the wisdom of it, and exposed the operation. And when those witnesses were asked whether they would find the new Obama administration proposed reporting rule helpful in fighting gun trafficking, those ATF witnesses said they would find it very helpful. And you know what Daryl Issa did? He tried to shut them down. He tried to tell them that that kind of testimony was beyond the scope of the hearing, that the hearing was not to consider whether we need stronger laws and stronger regulations. And his own witnesses, who he called himself to that hearing, testified that based on their experience with trying to enforce federal gun laws, the Obama administration rule would be very helpful.
Well, Dennis Hennigan, again, the acting president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence and founder of the Center's Legal Action Project. He's also the author of Lethal Logic, Exploding the Myths That Paralyze American Gun Policy. We may not be having an intelligent debate about it here in this country, but there's certainly a lot of outrage down in Mexico, including President Calderon blasting the gun dealers and the firearms regulations in this country. And he said that there's a connection between the guns and profits from the U.S. Sale of drugs, because obviously we're the market for these drugs that the cartel make profit from. He said it's partly to blame for this firebombing in a casino just recently in Monterrey that left 52 people dead, and apparently has, in a country that's been seen sort of endless brutality, apparently this is almost too much for the Mexican people. They're absolutely outraged.
No, that's right. And a coalition of hundreds of Mexican advocacy groups, peace groups, non-governmental organizations is joining together with the Brady Campaign and other gun control groups in America have a petition to President Obama to take decisive action against this trafficking, and that petition appears on our website at www.bradycampaign.org. President Calderon has been absolutely eloquent. He went before the United States Congress last year and made a plea for the United States to try to control this kind of trafficking, because tens of thousands of these assault rifles are moving from U.S. gun shops into the hands of the Mexican cartels, and they are fueling this kind of unspeakable violence in Mexico. And the President Calderon pointed out that the violence got so much worse when the U.S. assault weapon ban expired in 2004. That's when it started to climb. That's when the cartels realized that because of Mexican gun laws being so strict, they couldn't get these assault rifles in Mexico, so they began resorting to border state gun shops, and they're shipping them down to Mexico by the truckload.
And these include AK-47 assault rifles and the Barrett 50 caliber sniper rifles, and those they are capable of shooting down a 747. I mean, this is serious ordnance that's getting into the hands of criminals, and it's just a matter of time, I think, before there's some outrage like shooting down an aircraft.
Yes, these 50 caliber sniper rifles simply have no place in civilian society whatsoever. They are weapons of war, and yet the gun lobby, again, will do everything it can to prevent restrictions even on those kinds of guns, which are clearly terrorist guns. I mean, they can shoot down an airplane taking off from any of our major airports, and yet they are easily accessible in gun shops and gun shows throughout this country.
So, just in closing, Dennis Hennigan, the NRA clearly has got the Congress intimidated. And not just Republicans who faithfully support them, but also a lot of Democrats. And as you've noticed, I'm sure to your great frustration, the Democratic Party simply won't talk about gun control. What do you think is going to break the kind of lock that they've got over the Congress? Because my understanding is that there's a huge gap between the leadership of the NRA and their sort of fanaticism and the rank and file members of the NRA who are actually, you know, they've been polled and they actually believe that there should be some reasonable gun control.
Yes. I mean, this is a very peculiar issue where the American political system is simply not generating the kinds of policies that are favored by the vast majority of the American people. There have been surveys of gun owners and NRA members themselves showing that upwards of 70 to 80% of NRA members themselves favor such reforms as extending Brady Bill background checks to all gun sales, including all sales at gun shows, or enacting legislation that would bar the sale of guns to people on the terrorist watch list. those are people who right now are barred from getting on airplanes because of their ties to terrorism, but they can go in and buy as many assault rifles as they want. And this is crazy, and the American people think it's crazy, and so do most gun owners and NRA members. So what you have is gun policy in this country being dictated by a small minority of ideologically driven extremist gun owners who find their voice in the leadership of the National Rifle Association, and it's a very intimidating voice. And it's past time for our politicians to stand up to these bullies at the NRA and start listening to the average gun owner and start listening to the American people in formulating gun policy.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Dennis Hannigan.
It's been my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Dennis Hannigan, who is the acting president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. He's the founder of the Center's Legal Action Project and the author of Lethal Logic, Exploding the Myths That Paralyze American Gun Policy. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Iraq.
Shot the sheriff. The sheriff, the buzz, I swear it wasn't something else. Ooh, 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 yeah. I said I shot the sheriff. Oh Lord, and they say there's a capital offense. Ooh, 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 yeah. Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Roed Jarrah, who is an Iraqi-American political analyst and blogger. He first gained international prominence as the person referenced in the blog, Where is Raed? He has written From Baghdad, by the pseudonym author Salman Pax. While the U.S. invaded Iraq, Jarrah and his family compiled their own posts in the book The Iraq War Blog, an Iraqi family's inside view of the first year of the occupation. In 2003, he worked as a country director for Civic Worldwise, the only door-to-door civilian casualties survey in Iraq. He also founded MR, a non-governmental organization that carried out humanitarian and reconstruction work in Baghdad and southern Iraq. He currently lives in Washington, D.C., but has just but maintains these ties in Iraq and just traveled there a few weeks ago. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roed Jarrah.
Thank you for having me.
And clearly, there's been a political paralysis in the green zone in the government since the last election, which one group of coalition won, and yet the losing coalition ended up in control because of parliamentary maneuvers, etc. And I understand the support of Iran, it's, you know, the U.S. is pulling out of a country they devastated. And the question's always been, is this government capable of governing? And it seems to sort of be almost an extension of the U.S. Green zone, you know, illusory bubble, if you will. Is it still the case that there's the green zone and then there's the rest of Iraq?
Yes, unfortunately, this is still the case. This is not surprising to many people, including myself, who said all along that functional democracy will not be imported to Iraq by the U.S. tanks. So 8 years later, we see the real, you know, practical reality of what happened after the U.S. invaded. There is a dysfunctional, corrupt, sectarian government that is hiding in the green zone, a government that has failed miserably in protecting Iraq's sovereignty, and in providing basic services to Iraqis. So this is not—it's not, you know, a surprising outcome. And actually, I would have been very surprised if there was a functional Iraqi government. I would be surprised if there was a government that is seen as legitimate by Iraqis, as long as the U.S. continues to occupy Iraq. I think this situation is not an exception. This is the norm of how fake governments look like, how governments that exist under foreign military occupations look like.
Well, my understanding, though, is that Roy Gerard, is that that the Obama administration really does want to get the troops out. They do want to save the money. They are bogged down in Afghanistan, and as you know, we have serious problems with the budget here at home. What would keep the United States in the country?
The White House seems to be sincere about its intention to withdraw the troops. I have been following the White House statement very closely since President Obama took office, and they were all very consistent. They all promised a very clear plan to withdraw the U.S. Forces completely by the end of this year, bringing down the number of U.S. troops to zero and the number of U.S. Military bases to zero. This promise has been repeated over and over and over. At the same time, there has been pushback by the U.S. Pentagon and the national security establishment here in Washington, D.C. That does not take any of the main reasons arguments for leaving Iraq seriously, because the way that they see it, they just want to have a permanent base there, a permanent intervention in Iraq for geopolitical reasons. They don't care about how much that's costing us and how much that will cost the future generations in the U.S. They don't care about how many people have been killed from this side. They care about some ideological and geopolitical calculations that they had all along, and they still stick to it. So unfortunately, what is happening now is that President Obama seems to be caving, as usual, when we are approaching the deadline. It seems that he is being pushed around by the old guards of the Pentagon, by the national security establishment that is not accountable, not elected in the U.S. It seems that he is being pushed around. He's not playing the leadership role that he must be playing by setting a very clear message that we are going to end this war in Iraq, not only because we don't have money to continue it, but because it has been a disaster, a moral disaster, a political disaster, a disaster, a legal disaster. It has been a disaster for both Iraqis and Americans for the last 20 years, since it started in 1991, and it must end as promised. Unfortunately, President Obama is not playing this role yet, and the next few months will be extremely sensitive and important to deciding the future of the bilateral relationships between the U.S. and Iraq.
Again, I'm speaking with Iraqi-American political analyst and blogger Royad Gerard, who recently returned from Iraq. Now, if the U.S. president was able, was good to his word and was able to overcome the resistance in the Pentagon and pull all the American troops out by the end of the year as promised, what's going to happen to Iraq? Is there stability? What will fill the power vacuum?
What will fill the power vacuum is Iraqis. And this doesn't doesn't mean necessarily the Iraqis who are running Iraq now in the green zone. There might be another group of Iraqis or another Iraqi regime or another Iraqi establishment that will build itself without the U.S. presence. I think the U.S. withdrawal will not lead to a sudden situation where Iraq is stable overnight. You know, there is no silver bullet that will solve the situation in Iraq. Iraq is a disaster. It has been deteriorating for the last 20 years, and I think Iraqis will need decades, not years, decades, to fix the destruction that has been subject, or the destruction that happened in their infrastructure, and the damage that happened to the civil society, the Iraqi demographics. The U.S. withdrawal is only the first step in that process. I think as long as the U.S. keeps a single U.S. soldier in Iraq, Iraq is not on the right path. Iraq is not even starting the process of reconciliation and reconstruction. But once the U.S. withdraws completely, brings all the soldiers and all the bases and all of the contractors and foreign mercenaries outside Iraq, that will allow Iraqis to work on solving the problem. So I personally think Iraq will need at least another 10 years to reach to a point where reconstruction and reconciliation can start. Imagine how bad the situation is that we need to wait until 2020 until reconstruction and reconciliation starts, not end, you know?
Right. Well, that isn't a... That's a really shocking statistic, Royed Gerard. Just in the last couple of minutes, though, a lot of analysts say, clearly the Iraqi people have lost terribly. They had a very functioning country. They had a terrible leader, but they had a functioning country. It's been destroyed. The U.S. clearly did not win this war. The Iraqi people clearly did not win anything. They've suffered a lot. Analysts say the only winners are in Iran, the extent to which the Maliki government seems connected to Iran. But I just wanted to ask you in the last minute, since there's an instability next door in Syria and the possibility of the Sunni revolutionaries taking over, and this is alarming the regime in Tehran, could there be a spillover into Anbar and reignite sectarian tensions in Iraq?
Sectarian tensions have not left Iraq. The sectarian tensions that were brought to Iraq in 2003 became, unfortunately, a part of the Iraqi system. This is how the Iraqi ruling parties see the country, and this is how the Iraqi ruling parties see the region. Actually, I would look at the entire situation the other way around. The sectarian understanding, this analysis that see the uprising in Syria through sectarian lenses, are a spillover of the Iraqi conflict. The way that the U.S. introduced these divisions in Iraq, these divisions are actually spreading to the rest of the region. I personally still refuse to see the uprising in Syria as a sectarian uprising, a Sunni uprising against Shiites or against Alawis in the case of Syria. I think it is less sectarian than that. There have been more. There are many indications that it is a popular uprising against an oppressive regime. But I agree with you in the sense that all of the Iraqi ruling parties, the Sunni and Shiite and Kurdish sectarian ruling parties, see the uprising in Syria through these sectarian lenses. They understand it through sectarian terms, and that's why now the U.S. inserted and supported regime in Iraq is ironically supporting the Syrian regime, not because it's a good regime, but because they think it's a regime that is closer to them from a sectarian point of view. I think this is extremely devastating, very sad to see how low the Iraqi political scene has reached, how the Iraqi regional calculations ended up being so narrow-minded and going through these religious and partisan calculations.
Well, I'm afraid
is the same in
Syria. I'm afraid we've run out of time here, Rawed Gerard, but I thank you for joining us. And again, I've been speaking with Rawed Gerard, an Iraqi-American political analyst and blogger who is a co-author of the Iraq War blog and Iraqi Families Inside View of the First Year of the Occupation. He currently lives in Washington, D.C., but was visiting Iraq just recently. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began, our lead story was a story that should be the leading story in the country. It explains why we're paying so much for food and gasoline. And it's a very simple story. It's told by Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, how Wall Street, through five commissioners, are able to literally gouge millions from the pockets of the average Americans for no purpose at all except to enrich a handful of people and impoverish most Americans, and that the price of gasoline and food are entirely distorted and completely artificial. And he makes a very, very clear case. He obviously knows, he's been there and done it, and he really lays out the landscape. And it's, frankly, I don't understand why the people in this country aren't up in arms and the pitchforks aren't descending on Wall Street, because this is a highway robbery with a license to steal. Then we talked to about the reassignment, in quotes, of the head of ATF. Well, ATF, of course, Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, Explosives Bureau, has always been undermanned. And the NRA have tried to put them out of business. They have had acting directors for many decades now. And it's all over this sting that went wrong on the Arizona border with Mexico, where 2,500 high-powered firearms, where ATF lost track of them. Well, the point is that the Congressman Daryl Issa, who's making a big fuss over this, is a complete hypocrite, because, frankly, the Republicans and a lot of Democrats are doing everything they can to weaken the already weak gun controls laws in this country at the behest of the NRA. And that's the real story in this. And then finally, we spoke with Rawed Gerard, the Iraqi-American political analyst and blogger, about what's happening in his country. And it's not a pretty picture. Political paralysis, a total disconnect between the green zone and the rest of the country, and the possibility of sectarian and violence being renewed, particularly spilling over from the revolution in Syria. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Land.